Inflation and economic turmoil in countries like Afghanistan, Pakistan, Egypt, and Syria has made the Eid sacrifice.
So, welcome everyone to the end of architecture.
The walls are going to start collapsing on us right now.
Yes. Hopefully not. Hopefully not. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's correct.
I don't know if anybody listened to this NPR or BBC interview. This in South Korea in Seoul, a department store caved in. It was her last day of work. She was a
student, wow.
And but she survived under the rubble.
Wow.
Okay. Apropos of what
you yes. Said. So on that note, we'll get right into it. My name is Matthew Schlup, for those of you who don't know me. I've been practicing residential architecture for a little over 2 decades. This is my third year teaching here at CMU Osher. Thrilled to be here. I always enjoy presenting this material. And I also welcome feedback from you guys as far as any questions or comments or suggestions to improve it. This is primarily for your benefit, even though I personally feel that I get more out of it than you guys. And so before we get started here, I wanted to make sure everyone got a copy of the syllabus. It's the front here if you didn't. So with a title like The End of Architecture, I think we have to begin with asking a question, why is architecture ending? And there's several reasons to that we're going to get into over the next 5 weeks, or I guess 6 weeks. But before we get into those reasons, I want to ask a more general question. What is architecture? For me, architecture at its root or at its essence is something that defines space. So that can be a physical thing. It could also be a non-physical thing as well. Architecture is a term that's kind of thrown around quite a bit in common society. And I think that kind of gets to the essence in my mind as well, where it defines space from an architect's perspective, but in a non-architectural or architect's perspective, it's kind of a definer. One of the first forms of architecture, and if you go back in history, you could probably make an argument for that being the wall. And again, so, you know, just kind of going to generals, what is a wall? And that, keeping in simple terms, is something that divides space. So we have architecture that defines space, and then we have walls that divide space. Pretty simple. Walls not only divide space, but organize space into smaller parts. Physical separation, I guess in the early times it probably was to keep the sheep in, or maybe keep the wolves out, type thing. And when those walls are circular in fashion, they create an enclosure. And that really is where architecture really starts to take hold. The sense of enclosure that you have that's created primarily by walls, but can be created by other elements as well that we'll get into here today. But this sense of enclosure is really at the heart of what we study as architects. How do you create this sense of enclosure that we're experiencing as in this room that we're in right now, for example? And in particular, in my mind, it's not so much the physical aspect, but it's more the metaphysical part of this sense of enclosure, what I like to refer to as this idea of insideness, that when you're within an enclosure, you are perceiving this idea that you're inside of something or you're a part of something. This idea of a feeling that you perceive, it's palpable of this insideness. And this really gets to really the essence of these metaphysical feelings that are created by physical structures. And that, for me, what I've really looked at for decades over my career, going all the way back to graduate school, is this way that these physical elements can create these metaphysical feelings within our perception. And these perceptions are not necessarily so tangible or so clearly obvious as far as where they're coming from, but that this study is really what makes architecture interesting for me. That said, architecture is made with more than just walls. Second probably to walls would be a roof structure. This roof structure, generally speaking, is there to provide shelter. Shelter from things like the rain or the sun, but also, again, metaphysical shelter as well. A third element would be the floor, or what's considered the ground plane or a frame that we reference ourselves to. It symbolically represents the earth or the ground, a foundation that we kind of reference or work from. A fourth element would be a door, which is like a passage through a wall. So these walls that came along, these openings in the walls or thresholds, where you pass from one side of the wall to the other, is what we generally refer to as a door. And then finally, a fifth element would be a window. Window generally is more difficult to pass through than a door, but is used primarily just to maintain a connection from one side of the wall to the other, one space to another, visually, a visual connection, as well as the other senses. And so with these five elements, walls, roof, floor, door, and windows, we can pretty much study and understand the entire history of architecture as far as breaking architecture down to these real general elements, but also by studying and seeing how these elements relate to each other, can get a better understanding of how a particular building is creating these sensations that is really at the heart of it, this like the sensation of enclosure. And so we're going to get a little bit into that today, just as an example of this, is a child's drawing of a house, for example. Children are interesting, in particular kindergartners are my favorite. Because they abstract architecture down to its basic elements. These five elements we just talked about, we can see them here in this image, as well as additional elements like the flowers and the sun. And for children, each one of these elements not only represent something tangible or something physical like this house or the flowers, but more so for children than adults, they also represent these feelings. They go back to these sensations that where the house really, in a child's mind or a child's eye, is more animate than what we as adults perceive it as an inanimate object. And so you'll find quite often with children's drawings, they'll colorize the house or exaggerate the color, which also adds a way for them to kind of interpret their feelings of the house, whether the house makes them feel happy or makes them feel sad. Will come through in the colors that they render it with, or even, for example, in the sun, you'll quite frequently see a smiley face in the sun, which will also, again, express whether the scene that they're trying to convey is a happy feeling, or even just the flowers being generally symbolic of friendliness or a garden. And so if we take the flowers and the sun away and we just look at the house, even the house, the way that they render it, if you ask a child to draw a picture of a house and you don't give them any kind of reference point, most children will draw a picture of their own house because that's the house they're most familiar with. But Second to that, they'll also render a house very often like this, with two windows and a door, almost creating a face on the house, to where, again, the house is becoming personified. And this this kind of application of bringing the house to life is not so much something they're applying, but something that they're feeling, that they feel that the house is alive and animate, and it's more than just these this structure that's made of inanimate materials. So we look at these elements, like a door and a window that are in a wall. These two, as we look at them as a trained eye, give away clues as well. The flowers, again, speak to who's living behind this wall. Their feelings towards the street or the people on the street. And that nature that you find, you can, even in addition to the windows and the doors, but even the makeup of the wall itself, speaks to the patterns that have built up over time, layered through time, speak not only to how the structure has changed over time, but it also speaks to some also what's going on behind those walls in these different places, just by the relationships of the various elements that are coming through on the exterior that are reflective of things that have happened on the interior. They also quite frequently will articulate a story. Like here we see a window frame that's been reduced down to a smaller window frame. Speaking again to this occupant's needs change over time as far as the need for the size of the window reducing down, or maybe a rearrangement on the interior space where there was a conflict with the larger window. And so, with going back again to the child's sketch, I like to use these drawings as a tool to identify elements within a building to have significance. It's kind of a shorthand or a quick way to be able to find the things that resonate perceptually as you look at a building. And so, as an example, the things that are drawn in these small little sketches are the things that the person making these drawings resonate with them. The things that they leave out are things that they don't resonate or they're not picking up on. And so this as a designer of structures helps me out because I can tell what things maybe that I want to resonate that are not resonating because they're not coming up in the drawings that I need to pay a little more attention to try to articulate them a little bit more or vice versa. But then also, in addition to that, another trick that with drawings, especially with the children's drawings, is that you can start to eliminate things from the drawing, such as taking the windows out here as an example, and try to figure out or try to get at what's the essence of this house. What one single element, if you had to identify a single element that defines a house, and a quick way to get to that is to take things away one at a time. As long as the feel or the sense of a house is still there, then we know we're on the right path. But then once we eliminate something, that the house disappears, that's a clue that we've missed it. And so as an example, when we take the windows out and we just have a door, it's less of a house, but it still has the feel of a house. Or in reverse, we take the door away and we keep the windows. Again, similarly, it still feels like a house as we look at it. Take the doors and windows away, and now we just have the walls and the roof. Again, it still feels like a house, but if we take the roof away, now it feels like maybe the house is gone. That we have walls that enclose a space. Again, the walls function to make the space that you occupy inside here as if you're enclosed. But without a roof overhead, open to the sky, it just feels like maybe much like an open space that's been confined. By reverse, if we put the roof back and we take the walls away, that's true. We have to figure out how we're going to keep the roof up, but assuming for a moment that we can keep this roof suspended, it feels a little bit more like a house than the previous slide with just the walls. And so, that being said, the nature of a roof to provide shelter, we find that for a house, the idea or the concept of shelter is actually more central to the core of the idea of a house than enclosure that the walls provide. And so even though a house is providing all these different elements and many more, we can really get to the essence of a house is about shelter. And so, more significantly, related to today's lecture and also this course in general, is that a house is able to shelter without any walls, just the roof. And so that begs the question, if you don't have the walls to create this sense of enclosure, can a house be a house that shelters but does not enclose? And that really is what we're going to be looking at here today. We're going to look at four houses that are probably the most significant houses from an architectural standpoint from the 20th century. And in these four houses, we're going to see a progression from the first house to the fourth house, where all four of these architects are moving in that direction. They're trying to provide a house with shelter, but taking away this sense of enclosure. More specifically, over the next 5 weeks, even after today, we'll see how the wall has been eliminated, like we're seeing here, and replaced by the window. If you were to look at an architectural element in the 20th century, the window is probably the key element. The development of the window over the 20th century in the modern movement. And so this window that's changing and transforming over the last 100 years is one of the transformations it's making is it's taking the place of the wall. It's eliminating the wall. It's this idea of this entropic desire to dissolve away a sense of enclosure. Again, walls representing this kind of sense of enclosure. Modern architecture has moved in this direction of trying to dissolve this idea of enclosure away. Still feeling sheltered, that's provided by the roof. And so, we'll start off here with Frank Lloyd Wright, who was speaking. I'm going to read a brief passage here from a lecture that he gave in 1930 at Princeton, and he was speaking on the topic of the future of architecture, where he said, "American homes of slanderous liars and poetry crushers, the suburban house parade. Any popular avenue or suburb will show you the polyglot encampment displaying on the neatly kept little plots, a theatrical desire on the part of fairly respectable people to live in chateaus, manor houses, Venetian palaces, feudal castles, and the Queen Anne cottages. Look within all these typical monotony and variety, and see there the machine-made copies of handicraft originals. Imitation patterns and imitation textures stamped or printed by the machine. Imitations underfoot, imitations overhead, imitations all around you. To you, proud proprietors, do these things thus degraded mean anything aside from vogue and price? Aside from your sense of quantitative ownership, do you perceive in them some fine firmness in form, line, and color to the purposes which they serve? Are the chairs to sit in, the tables to use, the couch comfortable, and all harmoniously related to each other and to your own life?" Goes on to say, "A cheap substitute for ancient art and craft, which has no vital meaning in your own life or our own time. You line the box you live in as a magpie lines its nest. This is what has become of it. Of all conditions, this one at home is most deplorable. For to the homes of this country, we must look for any beginning of the awakening of an artistic conscience which will change this parasitic condition to independent growth. So here he's criticizing what has become of a home. He made most of his career out of designing houses. And in his when he was starting out here at the end of the 1800s, the houses that he was seeing, as he spelled out, could be found in almost any variety of style. And architects and designers would just switch them about at whim. He felt that this was not only a disgrace, but was more to the point, was degrading the homeowner by living in such a structure. So he answered this criticism in February of 1901. He took out an ad in the Ladies' Home Journal. We're seeing parts of this ad here, a one-page ad, where he had designed what he called a house in a prairie town. The concept was this prairie-style house that could be developed by developers, four on a lot, that would enclose a wilderness space between them and face to the exterior out across the open field, or what he referred to as the open prairie. These houses featured a fireplace at the hearth at the center of the home. Broad overhangs that we're seeing here, extended out. Screen windows, which had a patchwork of stained glass in the windows, and an elevated low base, which is really one of his strong suits, that the house is almost sitting up atop of a plinth. This low base was in reference to this this continuous horizon, open horizon, or the American plain, or prairie, as he referred to it. This was a reaction to the small, congested lots of the industrial city. He felt that the prairie house out in the country was a place to take advantage of the open, undeveloped American plain. So looking at this house in floor plan here, there's three central rooms. The living room here in the center with the fireplace, the dining room, and the library flanking the two sides of the living room. But the key concept that he was developing here was this idea that these three main living spaces were all open to each other. There wasn't any interior partition between them. So this idea of an open floor plan or an open space was something that he was proposing, this idea of continuous space that flows from one room to another. But then also in particular, one other key element here I'll point out, this is the bottom of the screen here is facing the street. Here's the front entry here into the house. He brings you in the backside of the main living spaces here on the backside of the fireplace where you move into the living room. And he's turned these three spaces perpendicular to the street so that way they can then have this commanding view off to the right across the open, the front open yard or open plain, the horizon. So this this continuous space as well as also this view were paramount to him in this concept. He then took this and had a chance to, from this ad in 1901, he got multiple commissions, but really where we see this prairie style house taken to its fullest, the best articulation of this concept is in the Robie House in Chicago in 1909. I'll read you here a passage from a description that he gave of this house, where he said it was a city dwelling with a south front built of slender brown bricks with stone trimmings roof tiled with copper cornices, a single room type similar to the Atomic, the Coolmley and the Thomas houses, well open to the south with balcony and enclosed garden. Sleeping rooms added in a Belvedere. Gallery rooftop commanding fine views. The garage connected to the house with servants' rooms overhead. There was no excavation except for a heater and coal. And most importantly here is last sentence. He says, a highly developed working out of organic relation between exterior and interior. Clean sweeping lines and low proportion, preserving openness and airiness of feature and arrangement throughout. So on these points, we see in the floor plan here, the main floor plan, we see again a similar strategy to what we saw in the Prairie House. The staircase here brings you and arrives to the center of the house. The fireplace also again located in the center of the house. We arrive on the back side of the fireplace, pass along it here into the main living room. Off to here is the dining room. Here he has a little bit of different strategy where the main living spaces are not completely open. He's using the fireplace as a screen between them, creating pairing between these two spaces. But most significantly is this dotted line here, where he's putting these spaces in line on axis, flanking the two ends with these the windows here at the two far ends. And this idea of this continuation, so the space not only continues between the living room and the dining room, but then it continues out through the window and across the open prairie, almost infinitely. We also see on the southern side facing the street here, he's lining the walls here with a series of doors. This is the first instance that we spoke about where he's starting to remove the wall and he's replacing them with doors. So now you have all along the entire length of these spaces, you have access to pass through any one of these doors out onto the balcony to move from the interior space to the exterior space, making that connection physically in addition to just visually. Yes?
Is there a reason why it's in German? Was it advertised in German?
Yes, I'll get to that here in about 5 minutes, if you can just be patient. There's a reason. Good, nice point. I'll large here a little bit closer so you can read the German a little bit easier. So that's another great question. We'll go downstairs. And so he brings you into the house, and he disguises, this being the front of the house down here on the street, he brings the entry in around the back side of the house here, so where the front door is not visible from the street. You arrive at this entry hall, and then you take a set of stairs up to the main level. Down at the lower level here, he's got a billiard room, as well as the children's playroom here on the right. Again, these have the same windows here that are opening these spaces out. And here you can see he's drawing the same horizontal datum line through here to align these, being really the key central point of this this house partie. Up on the third floor, the bedrooms that are sitting up, what you refer to as the Belvedere. You've got the main living master bedroom at the top of the stairs. On center, you come into the bedroom, again, looking across the windows out over to the view, commanding view out over the front street. Here's a rendering that he did. Of this, of the bedroom suite sitting up perched atop the roof. And we can also see the main living room and dining room here, the series of doors, all of them with his typical stained glass pattern work, and then also repeated down at the lower floor. He's taken these three floors that are generally with all three floors exposed, a rather large, tall house. But he's created this sense of horizontality by the strong, dominant, continuous line
by the roof line, as well as this base plinth that's uninterrupted by any of the other elements that are that it's engaged with, and by doing so creates a low sense to the house despite the fact that it's three stories tall. So if we, we're gonna walk through the house real quickly here. If we move from the street here to the left, we pass by here on the sidewalk, you can see close up on the brick, a detail that he's done here where he's striped the horizontal mortar joints to get a shadow line, but he's filled the vertical mortar joints in solid to make, in a mortar that's a similar color to the brick, to make them visually disappear. To again create these strong horizontal lines that are uninterrupted. We work our way around the corner here. Also take note of the strong roof line here that's cantilevering out from the house, unsupported out on here on the corners. Again, playing into this effect of continuation uninterrupted from the house. And then we get around to the side and we can see back in. Again, still the front door is in shadow, not entirely apparent. But if we work our way back through this narrowing, we find it here at the end. We pass through into the entry, and then we have a set of stairs that takes you up and elevates you up to the main living space. When we arrive at the top of the stairs, looking towards the living room, he brings you in the corner of the room, looking across the room in a diagonal fashion as opposed to in line in a more classical form. But most significantly, two things are happening here in this room. One, again, the bay window here at the end that's pointed creates this visual effect. If you could imagine this room being the long side front wall here and then turn with another straight wall without the bay window, the room would have a feeling of enclosure despite the fact that he's got these windows and doors and so much daylight coming through. By putting not only a bay at the end, does it make a relief to that wall to where the room doesn't feel as enclosed, but also turning that bay towards on a point creates this feeling where this room just continues on beyond the windows themselves. Another thing that he's doing here that gets into this plasticity, another theme for this course that we're gonna be talking quite a bit about, this idea of these new materials that are being used in new ways, new types of construction. Are these plastic materials, concrete, steel, glass, that are coming online in the 19th century and 20th century. He's taking the ceiling or the roof of this space and the walls, again, these two elements that are very common in defining architecture, and he's taking the molding across the roof, turning it down the side, back across the soffit here, then back down, and by doing so, he's creating this almost this plastic feel where the ornamentation and detailing within the space is just dripping or flowing down across, transitioning from the roof to the wall without having this really hard definitive line. And so this is an element that we're gonna see going forward where this clear definition between the wall and the roof is no longer defined. Again, these elements that we outlined here a few minutes ago, clearly defining one to the other, part of what's happening in the modern movement is they're blurring this kind of division between these elements. And we're seeing some elements of that here in Wright's work, and that's going to be progressing as we go forward.
Light is a major element here. What are the north, south, east, west directions here?
So this is the side that faces the street, which is south. So this is the window here is pointing to the west and the opposite to the east.
Yeah, it seems to me that the doors are becoming windows.
That's correct. They're acting as windows. Right. Exactly right. But despite that, they still function as a door. You can
right.
pass through them.
They're both.
That's right. And so again, he's also kind of blurring the line again between these two elements as well. Great point. If we stand in the living room, look back in the opposite direction, you can see the fireplace here dividing the space between the living room and the dining room beyond. But he's also carved out here in the dining room or in the fireplace so that way you can see the ceiling pass through it. Again,
to create this idea of continuation, that it's not, that the fireplace is not completely interrupting your view. And so it enables the fireplace, despite the fact that it's creating a screen or a division between the spaces, it's not becoming a roadblock. He's allowing the space to flow around the sides as well as over top of it, between the two. If we take a quick look at the section here, a key element I'll point out is, one, he's got a pitched roof on here, which is something that people tend to forget, because down from the street, all you can see is this extended eave that he's creating down here on the roof line, which from the perspective of the street blocks out the view of that pitched roof. Another thing he's done here is the steel beam that he's got here and here that comes out this way to support this large cantilevering roof. This steel is this new modern material, but he's concealed it, wrapped it, hid it up inside the roof. He's not putting it out there on view, something that we'll see coming up in some future work. Here we have a view from the dining room looking back towards the living room, and you can see this complete extension of space, the continuation of space uninterrupted. This idea that we see in Wright's case, here's the dining room and the living room, and this view that we were just looking down here goes through the door. He doesn't even stop the space here, continues out onto the balcony, and then beyond at that point. You also can see some of his stained glass work. You can see referencing this floor plan in the glass itself, as well as also the inspiration of that from the prairie grass. So back to your question on the German in the text. The 1909, actually, as this house got underway for construction, wasn't completed, at the age of 42, he abandoned his family and practice, as his father had done, actually, and he left for Europe with his mistress, who was a former client, and he met up with Berlin's greatest art publisher, by a gentleman by the name of Ernest Wasmuth, to publish a portfolio of his work to date. He rented a villa in Florence where he and some of his apprentices set up shop, and they redrafted these prairie-style houses that he had been working on to prepare for this publication in 1911. This publication, they printed 1,000 copies, 500 of them sold out in Europe, mostly in Germany. They were, because there was this German publisher, the text was in German, so it was easily digestible by the Germans. But the Germans also, in architecture, there was a strong group or core that was developing into this Bauhaus movement that we'll get into a little bit. But these 500 copies sold out very quickly, very, very quickly disseminating his name around Europe and primarily in Germany as this preeminent American architect. He returned back home with the other 500 that he planned to sell in the United States, again, to help promote his name. Returned back to Wisconsin to his house, but then shortly thereafter, 1914, there was a fire in his house where he lost all but about a couple dozen of the prints. And so then he realized very quickly his mistake, and so then he took those couple dozen and he disseminated them to his apprentices as a gift for their work. And so then these got broken up into multiple hands and ensured them to be able to withstand these disasters. I'll read a quick passage here. He says, all of architecture, in this publication of this portfolio of plans and renderings that we're seeing here, he also had a text that went along with this. I'll read a quick paragraph here of this text. He says, all architecture worthy the name is growth in accord with natural feeling and industrial means to serve actual needs. So this sentence here is interesting because this being one of the leading sentences, one of the first few pages of this portfolio, he's saying the architecture, an architecture worthy of its name
comes out of this growth in accord with natural feeling and industrial means to serve actual needs. And so we see this kind of disconnect between right and the Europeans that we're going to be looking at here also today, where he put the emphasis on this natural feeling, this idea of organic feel, whereas the Europeans, Germans in particular, function more on his industrial means to serve an actual need, more of the functional side of form. Just a key difference there. So that brings us to our second architect, Le Corbusier. This is Villa Savoye in France, which was designed and built between 1928 to 1931. Couple decades or shortly after the Robey house that we just looked at. But one thing that's interesting about Corbusier is that when this portfolio that was being published was disseminated in 1911 through Europe and in Germany in particular, there was an architect, one of the leading architects in Germany at the time was a gentleman by the name of Peter Brenz. And in his office, he had, at the time, apprentices, young students by the name of Le Corbusier, Mies van der Rohe, and Walter Gropius. And so his office was really the hotbed that kind of really cemented this approach to design from Peter Brenz for these three gentlemen. But in particular, when this portfolio showed up in his office, Peter decided to shut the office down for the day, and they were just going to study his works. And so this kind of shows how much attention they put on Frank Lloyd Wright's work and how much significance they recognized immediately when they saw this portfolio and they saw the work, that this was the work of a very talented architect, an architect from America, which they had limited connection to. So this was an opportunity for them to see what was coming out of America, especially America that at that time was in the height of its industrial boom. Le Corbusier later acquired his own copy of the portfolio, which he would share with his own students once he became a professional. Austrian architects by the name of Rudolf Schindler, Richard Neutra, left Austria, came to the United States seeking out Frank Lloyd Wright after seeing this portfolio and wanted to work under him and learn from him. And so this portfolio immediately made Wright a sensation. But more significantly, we see, and we're going to see here, trails of Wright's designs filter through this European architecture that then also finds its way to America much later, and vice versa. When Wright was over in Europe for those couple years, he saw quite a bit of the European architecture, like the Viennese Secession. And that, when he came back to the United States and did some of his later work, you see trails and influence of those styles in his own work. And so there was a little bit of an exchange back and forth. This Villa Savoye, I point out here, the most important element on this building is this continuous ribbon window that goes from side to side. And you might notice that it looks a little bit familiar to the Robey house that we just looked at with the doors that went the entire length. Again, Corbusier is doing a similar thing. He's got the roof line uninterrupted across here. He's got this band of windows uninterrupted. And then even down below, the floor line of this main space that's creating the ceiling or the roof to the lower space, again, also uninterrupted. So he's got this continuous horizontal band because Corbusier had a similar affinity to Wright, a feeling that the horizontal line that represented the horizon was one of the most important elements in architecture. Here we see some diagrams from Corbusier making one of his points, whereas architecture in the past that was based on load-bearing walls and floors that were carried by these load-bearing walls. As a result of this, the loads having to be transferred down through these walls limited you on your design flexibility from floor to floor. His idea of taking the Villa Savoye, raising it up off of the ground, supported by these columns that we're seeing here, enabled to create more free space on the ground level. He's also putting a ground level up on top, a roof garden. And so he's doubled the real estate by using the building. And but also these PLOTs, he referred to them, these columns, became one of the key of his, what he called the 5 points of architecture. One being the PLOTs, these columns that raised the building up off of the ground plane. And we're seeing that provides the flexibility on the ground plane. The second point that he had was the free design of the facade. We're seeing here from inside the space, you can see the exterior wall here. These columns that raise up were that are supporting not only the walls and the floors on these columns, that enables these walls to be non-load-bearing walls. And so as a result, then he can create a continuous ribbon of these windows without having to worry about any kind of structural implication on these windows. That freed up his wall to basically do anything he wanted with it. Similar way, a third point was the free plan. These columns enable him without having any interior walls that were bearing, because all of the weight is being supported by these columns, enables him to play around with the floor plan, the arrangements of the rooms, without having to worry about any kind of structural implications. And then finally, his fifth point was the rooftop garden. Again, this doubling of the real estate, the ground level by raising the building up, and then putting more of this ground up on the top roof structure. So here we see the main living space. We can see the same type view that we saw with Wright, where the window continues down, turns the corner, continuous band, creating a 360-degree panoramic view. But then up onto the rooftop here, reaching the garden space. Again, the open exterior, in this case with Corbusier, is flowing into the interior of the house to the point where the division between interior and exterior is, again, being blurred even further than what we saw with Wright's Robie house. Here we can see a better view of the ramp here over on the right that takes you up to the garden space up above. And then finally, one last point here before we take a quick break. Standing outside, looking at the house from the oblique angle, this oblique angle becoming very important in the modern movement, much the same way that Wright brings you into his Robie house, the living room from the corner. This corner view is key to Corbusier. He's looking at the house as a cubist painting. He was a painter in addition to an architect. And the idea of being able to see three sides simultaneously in a single view, much the way that cubists would divide their paintings up and be able to see on a portrait, for example, multiple sides simultaneously. You're seeing the front of the house, you're seeing the side of the house, and by raising the house up off the ground plane, you're also seeing the underside of the house just from that single view. So that creates a much more dynamic, by seeing the three sides simultaneously, a much more dynamic volume to where the house now becomes a piece of more of sculptural art, more so than a functional building in the way that it's being handled, seeing the three sides simultaneously.
Were the ground, whatever that is on the third floor, was that innovative too?
Yes, so this round form here, this was a free form. In almost a foil in contrast to the strong rectilinear shape of the house. But this was a screen for the rooftop garden to create a backdrop. We're also seeing here a little opening here, another window without the glass as compared to these windows down here. But he's playing with these ideas of a window with glass, a window here transitioning without for the exterior spaces. He's really putting holes and Swiss cheese into this house to break down this barrier between interior and exterior. And again, it's this erosion away of the wall that we're seeing, much more so than we saw in Wright's Robie house.
What is on the first level?
Right, so he's got This was a place where he had a garage, you could bring your cars in, so like parking, but it also had a set of stairs that bring you up to there. Much the same strategy that Roby House had. He brings you into the main level or ground level, brings you up a set of stairs to the living space. It's a very similar strategy here.
Are these houses still standing?
They are. So with that, we're running a little bit behind schedule. We'll take a 10-minute break. We'll come back here at 2 o'clock. If you're interested during the break, I brought in a print of one of Wright's portfolio from the Wasmuth portfolio. This is the perspective view of the prairie style house that ran in the Ladies' Home Journal. So I'll leave that up here if you want to take a closer look at it. As well as I also have, I brought along a book, a study that I did of kindergartner drawings. So this is something I did as my kids were going through school, where I did an exercise with, we had the teachers at school ask them a prompt to draw a picture of a house, and that was like all they said. And so again, most kids will draw a picture of their own house if you ask them just to draw a house. Then the next day after they drew this picture, we brought them through my own house, which you may or may not be familiar with, but it's a little bit irregular, not your typical house. That's right. And then on the third day back at school, we had them ask the same prompt, draw a picture of a house. And we wanted to see how the pictures changed 2 days apart with viewing our house in between. And so this is a book that kind of pairs the before and after picture of each student.
You want to pass that around?
Or? Yeah, absolutely. Now you can pass that around.
Where's your house?
I'm up in the North Hills. I'm about a 15-minute drive out of the city, up in an area called Franklin Park, in the suburbs that Wright was. Actually, that's an interesting point. We're going to look at two here. We're going to see two more after the break, houses. But even going back before the 20th century, all of the most significant houses historically, architecturally, have all been in the suburbs. They're not in the city. It's an interesting thing.
The land.
Right.
Roby House.
Roby House is now in the city. But
that's right. That's right. The cities grow and they consume them. That's right.
That was completely redone after the war, right?
This? Yeah. Yes. Yeah, they went through a major renovation.
Yeah.
It's got a storied history, yes. It was.
There's the Gropius house in Chatham.
Yeah.
I was never in suburbs. Want me to hold this up for a minute?
Sure.
A real basic question. Will the architects design with and specify the materials that each part will be made with?
Yes.
Down to the brick being laid in that kind of cascading.
So you'll get, generally speaking, that's their role. But you will get architects that won't go to that level of detail. Obviously, the architects that are more well-known, like a Frank Lloyd Wright or a Corbusier, they will get into that detail because, as Mies said, which we'll see in the second half here, that design is in the details. And so paying that much attention to where they specify specific detail to go out to the job site and make sure that those details are being executed the way they want in order for the end product to be executed.
So is that what your practice was in doing residential?
Yes, yes, yes.
You specified all the materials outside and inside.
That's right, that's right. Yeah, in fact, that's why I was running a little bit late this morning, because I was at a job site this morning up way up north, and I was like rushing down to get back to the city. Because most of my time is spent in the mornings out at job sites, meeting with the contractors doing the building, to try to execute all those details accurately.
So how many structures that you designed are in a year?
I work just by myself. I'm a sole proprietor, which is kind of by design, so that way I can kind of control the entire product, as opposed to in an office where you have multiple people working on a project. And so, because I'm just by myself, I'm limited on how many projects I can take on at a time that I kind of manage. This last couple of years with this COVID that we've been experiencing has been throwing a curveball in residential to where it's crazy busy. It's busier than it's ever been in my entire career. So currently I'm taking on probably more projects than I should just to try to keep up. But generally speaking, I have maybe at any one time like 3 or 4 that will be under construction and maybe another 3 or 4 that will be in the design phase. At any given time. And a project can range anywhere from, depending on how large or small it is. You know, if it's just like a bathroom renovation, for example, it might only just take a couple months. But if it's a whole house design and build, then it could take a couple years. So, you know, it kind of runs the gamut. But yeah, it's definitely been a hectic past couple of years as far as work.
Is it totally customer driven, or do you design this and then sell it?
So a lot of architects will be, they'll have a particular playbook that they, or style or design that they're known for, that they're fond of. My approach to it is a little bit different, to where I try to follow the lead of the homeowner. And you know, everyone has different tastes and different styles that they like, or different desires and needs that they want out of the house. And so I get a lot of excitement out of just really customizing the house to a specific family or individual. The styles of houses range quite a bit. Like if you look at my portfolio of work, you know, it jumps around from, you know, French colonials to log cabins to, you know, more contemporary modern things like this. It really just comes back to the homeowner.
Really interesting.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Apology. Could miss the next 2 classes.
Okay.
My wife signed us up for an Alaska cruise.
Oh, nice. Well, that's a good excuse.
I will be here for
the last couple.
Last 3.
Yeah, nice. Excellent.
I'm Tony Poley.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Enjoy your trip.
Oh, thank you.
It's a nice nice place to be.
Friends are going, so it's a good job.
What, you said a cruise?
Yeah, so we're starting in Anchorage. And
okay.
Nice.
The Keys Rocks was nice too. Anywhere out of the city.
Thanks. This one in the print.
Is it in Chicago?
So this house was the design he created for the Ladies Home Journal, which was a house that was never realized, never built. It was just a design concept. So it just occupied the magazine.
And where is the Roby House in Chicago?
It's in the South Side, down near the university. Much like the city, the university has kind of grown and swallowed it.
Doesn't the university own it?
It does, yeah. I think they maintain it.
Other than its historic value, what do you think Zillow would...
would the land is more than the house.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I would love to talk to the Zillow-type people that create that software to see if they factor in, you know, like the provenance of a piece, you know, whether that factors into the appraisal. I mean, you know, an appraiser should factor that in, but, you know, like the software I'm wondering if that's part of the algorithm. I assume it is, but it'd be interesting to see what that algorithm is.
Because the Farnsworth house was for sale, well, maybe 10 years ago. It's been quite a while. They couldn't, no one would touch it.
Yeah.
And they couldn't, they were trying to give it to like the Smithsonian. Nobody wanted it. It needed dikes built.
Right, right. Yeah, you get a house that floods, and that definitely is a deal killer for most people.
I don't know who, somebody must have finally bought it.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that one. I think it's not an individual, but I think it's a fund. Yeah. But it's definitely has a major maintenance cost associated with it because of the waters.
They're adorable.
Right. So I'm gonna get back into it since we're running behind. This is our third architect we're looking at here, Mies van der Rohe with the Farnsworth House in Illinois. This was in 1945 to 1951. We see here, much like the Ville Savoy, he's raised it up off of the ground on these pilotis using a similar strategy to Corbusier. Not surprising that since they kind of came up together in under Peter Brenn's practice. We also see that the ribbon windows that we saw in Ville Savoy have now grown. And they've expanded upward towards the roof line and downward towards the floor to where now they've completely eliminated the wall. So this transition that we saw beginning with Wright has now reached by mid-century the full elimination of the wall and replaced by the window. Because the wall's missing, the need for privacy, he creates the curtain that goes across the window. The curtain being movable much more easily than a wall can be moved, so it has the flexibility to transition for the particular need at the moment. Interestingly enough, much like Ville Savoy, he's rendered it in white. In contrast to all the greenery nature that we're seeing around it, where Wright embraced kind of this organic friendliness to the natural surroundings. The Europeans wanted to kind of set themselves apart in contrast, almost an abstraction from nature. As we approach the front entryway here, we also see a very classical formal approach on the orthogonal. To the house in difference to the diagonal that we were talking about just before the break. But then once we arrive up on this first terrace here, we see that he is taking advantage of this diagonal vista much the same way that Corbusier and Wright were using this. And in particular, in his case, we see that his alignment of his pilotis, he's not placing them on the corner. He's allowing the roof plane and the ground floor plane to pass alongside these columns uninterrupted. So the plane itself is uninterrupted line, as well as the column is an uninterrupted line. But more significantly, by not having on the corner, the roof plane as well as the floor plane render much like a right cantilever on the Roby House, where it's this abstraction or reference to this gesture of continuation out into the landscape.
Like floating.
Floating, exactly. If we look at the floor plan, we can see, again, right. And it's interesting, you know, much like we were talking about the children's drawings at the beginning, you can tell a lot by a drawing, and the way that Mies renders his drawings compared to a Frank Lloyd Wright drawing speaks volumes, not only just about the illustrator, but also the drawing is trying to, in the way that it's rendered, trying to speak to the idea in the architecture. And so in this case, for example, his floor plan, he's rendering completely absent of any type of interior other than this small little core block here. And then he labels the rest of it as the house. And so we see, again, we can see in plan, we can see the PLT steel columns, how he's got them out beyond the line of the glass that encloses the space, but a complete absence of any type of wall that we're seeing in the plan.
In the plan you show, you can't even see the doors. Are there doorkeeping units?
Right, so this is getting a little bit closer here on the house itself. You can see the French door here on the side where he's bringing you into the house in the center on axis, very classical format. But then the two sides down here, glass and glass here. So that because the house is elevated up off of the ground, there's just this one way in and out from the end here. As you enter into this entry, this is the view that you get across the space. Much we saw with the Roby House, the space is continuous around this main central mass that kind of houses the more functional aspects of the house, the kitchen, the fireplace, the toiletries. And then from the other end looking back, you see this effect, again, that we saw in the other two houses, this continuous openness that turns the corner uninterrupted, this continuation of the view 360.
What about the insulation on this thing?
That's a great question. Not the most efficient house. This, if we move back to the far corner opposite of the entryway, you can see the bedroom area. Again, the bedroom defined by this single plane, the one side of this central volume. You can see as you go around here, you can see the counter for the kitchen. Running down the length, and then at the far end you can see the chair of the dining room set at the opposite of the house. Again, the functioning of these spaces, sleeping space, the cooking space, the dining space, all of that stuff is uninterrupted as the space flows around it, this continuation of space, even to the point it's even flowing across the top. This volume doesn't interact with the ceiling, so the space even flows there. Much the same way we saw with Wright's fireplace. And so again, from the view, you get this complete connection to the exterior by the wall completely absent. It's almost as if you could just walk across the floor and step right out. Again, the detailing of Mies, which is what he's really known for, is these details. Just the skill that he brought, the curtain that creates the privacy when needed. The curtain turning the corner here, but even the curtain rail that's holding the curtain up just so cleanly hidden away at the top with the intersection between the glass and the ceiling in this very clean, crisp detail.
I'm just going to point out that I think both the Roby House and the Farnsworth House are open for tours.
That's right.
People get to Chicago. That's about 45 minutes out of the city, but it's certainly worth the...
worth the venture.
Oh,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Is there anything to open up to vent the house? I need to get air in.
He does. I mean, he has these things kind of skillfully hidden. I'll get into that a little bit here in the next slide. A great segue. You can see here underneath the house, much like the same way that Corbusier lifted Villa Savoy up off the ground, so you can see that third plane. In Villa Savoy's case, it was up above the eye line, so he had it finished off in smooth plaster. Here, this is not up above the eye line, so the underside of his house is a little bit less presented. But you can see the white peel of tees around the perimeter supporting it. This single stack here through the center is the functional stack that's bringing and taking out all of the more necessities of the house from a plumbing and heating and these types of perspective. Here's another close look at the detailing that he does here with the column. Keep this in mind as we go on to the next house here, which brings us to our fourth architect by the name of Philip Johnson. Philip Johnson in 1961 wrote in a letter, he said, "The entire modern movement looked at as an intellectual movement dating from Ruskin to Villa-le-Duc, going through the Workbund, Bauhaus, Le Corbusier, World War II, may be winding up its days." This was, again, in 1961. He's referencing to architecture coming to an end. "There is only one absolute today, and that is change. There are no rules, surely no certainties in any of the arts. There is only the feeling of a wonderful freedom, of endless past years of historically great buildings to enjoy. He goes on to say, I cannot worry about this new eclecticism. He says, even Richardson, who considered himself an eclectic, was not one. A good architect will always do original work, a bad one do bad modern work, as well as bad work that is imitative with historical forms. So here we have him referencing to this architecture by his times here in the 60s as this regiment that we see. Not only are the buildings kind of dissolving away, the walls disappearing, but even the rigor in the design is also starting to evaporate away into the postmodern era that he was really at the height of. So Philip Johnson, after traveling for 2 years around Europe and in the world to see some of the world's great architecture, came back and mounted an exhibition at MoMA, the Modern Museum in New York, an exhibition called Modern Architecture International Exhibition. And this was in 1932. And it featured the works of these new modern architects that were coming online by the name of Le Corbusier. He featured, here we're seeing in this exhibition, a model of Villa Savoy that we just took a look at. But in addition to that, it also featured the works of Mies as well as Wright. In this, what was referred to as the international style. In fact, interestingly enough, at this time, Johnson was not an architect himself. He was more a curator of architectural works and art as well. But this this exhibition in 32, when he went after this to go, he went to Harvard to try to get a degree in architecture to become an architect himself. The textbook, or the book from this exhibition, was used as the textbook at Harvard on modern architecture. So he came into that program with a little bit of an advantage. Then in the mid-40s, he started to work on a design for his own house and went through roughly about 80 different schemes in about two dozen different variations for a design for a house. But then during a trip to Chicago in 1946, visiting Mies's office in Chicago because he was putting together a showing of his work for a museum. And at that time, as he was going through his work, he came across this drawing here for the Farnsworth House that we're seeing. This idea of this glass house, or as Mies referred to it, as an all-glass Belvedere. And when Philip saw this, he immediately recognized that this was something really exciting. This idea of eliminating the walls and replacing them with glass. And so he immediately seized it and for his own house design, since he had gone through so many different iterations and couldn't land on something that he was excited about. And he decided to build his own glass house. He purchased a piece of land in Connecticut, New Canaan, Connecticut, which was the area that a group of his classmates from Harvard, they referred to as the Harvard Five, made up of Johnson, John Johansson, Elliot Noyes, Landis Gore, and Marcel Breuer being their teacher from Harvard. This group of five hung out together, kind of worked and talked together architecture, and became known for a particular style of architecture during this period. Most of these guys were all based in the Connecticut area. And so he purchased a piece of land there and started about building his glass house, trying to beat Mies to the punch so that way he could get kind of like the notoriety for this idea that he stole. We can see, in contrast to Mies's Farnsworth house, we can see his axis on the diagonal. He's taking in the house again, much like Corbusier and Wright, on the diagonal, three-quarter perspective, as opposed to the more classical orthogonal approach that Mies took. He had, he also, interestingly enough, he didn't raise his glass house up off the ground like we saw with Corbusier and with Mies. He lands it on the ground, and not only does he land it on the ground, but he accentuates the ground with this brickwork, patchwork pattern for the floor tiling in the house. So that way, the texture and the material of this brickwork that we're seeing also in the circular volume here that penetrates the roof, it becomes a strong visual element in contrast to the transparency of the glass. We can also see from this vantage point the roof line, again, in the case with Korb and Mies, this uninterrupted roof line. Here he takes a little less of an interest to create this purity here. He's actually even got some lights that break that line. He's got lights up on here on top. And what most significantly is the circular volume that's penetrating that. So he's playing with these volumes and forms interacting with each other more so than the purity of this uninterrupted kind of horizontal. And by doing so, his house speaks a little bit less to the horizontal horizon that's infinite and continuous. It's more about a grounding to a specific place. He's taking this house and he's putting it in a specific spot, and by doing so, he's creating a space that is more of a place as opposed to kind of like the infinite beyond.
Not very big, then.
No, it isn't. It's very similar in size to the Farnsworth house.
And it's also not white.
That's right. That's an excellent point. So it's detailed in black, kind of the opposite of white. And we'll see these two houses in particular, the glass house and the Farnsworth house, are great kind of like complementaries in their contrast in these elements, like the colorization. You can see very quickly how much it blends in with the surrounding, the trees. Each one of these elements don't stand out as strong contrast like we saw with the white columns in the Farnsworth house. They blend into their surroundings, much the way Wright's house would blend into the surroundings. So in that regard, he's a little bit more of Wright's playbook. He's returning, nevertheless, he's returning, even though he's presenting in a very modern way on the diagonal, he's returning to a lot of the classical detailing. We're seeing that he's bringing a line through here horizontally. The glass doesn't continue from the floor to the ceiling uninterrupted. He's got a wainscoting that's in here, a very classical form. We can see the brick herringbone pattern on the floor that creates almost like a carpet across the surface. The house itself goes back to Palladio's house in Italy, another suburban house, Villa Rotunda, some of you may be familiar with. And the main concept of this house was it was a four-sided house that was perfectly symmetrical in all directions. And so you had this circular space in the center. You had entrance from all four sides, a set of stairs that goes up through a colonnade, enters on axis in a very classical way. Even the interior rooms are all arranged in a very symmetrical fashion, almost kind of with disregard to how they're going to function, to maintain this complete symmetry in all directions. Johnson's taking the same approach to his house. He's got a four-sided house. He has a door, access the main door here, but he also puts on center doors on the other four sides. Unlike the Farnsworth house that just had a single entrance, he's referencing this classical four-sided. And this actually does a little bit more than what Mies did with his Farnsworth house, because he could only enter and come in one side. The other three sides were limited. Those glass walls were glass windows. They weren't doors like in the Roby house where you could go out through them. You were confined. And so in those spaces, you felt confined in those spaces. You could only exit at the one end. In this case, Philip Johnson, if he wants to come out this way or come out this way, he's not confined. So the space is a little bit less confining, less enclosed in that sensation as compared to the Farnsworth house. We can also see, much like in the Villa Rotunda, the circular center, he's off-centered to give it a little bit more of a modern asymmetry. This circular form becomes his bathroom for the more private concealed spaces. But then he has, much like in the Farnsworth house, he's got his kitchen counter, his bed suite, his living room, his dining room, his desk, work desk,
all of these open to a single space that flows around without any kind of interruption.
It looked like he built a greenhouse or something.
That's right.
Your top, is that true?
Well, the roof structure is a solid structure as far as it doesn't permit the light to come in like a greenhouse would. But significantly, in the detailing of Mises' Farnsworth house, the way he handles the column, this H column, as it's referred to here, he brings them where Mises had kept them off the corners, he puts them on the corners. And so it anchors the corner by doing so. And he's also brought the windows in very intricate way to where the one side of the window comes by and slides in and ties in on the side of the column. On the other side, it comes in and it ties in on the corner of the column. And so he's created this kind of articulation here that you're seeing from the exterior profile to add a little bit of ornament that's all created by these modern materials of steel. He's also inside the space where he's got his living room space that we're standing in here. He's separating that from the other spaces through art. He takes the artwork and uses it almost as a division, paneling between the two.
Would be a traditional painting.
Right, so the painting itself is a very traditional classical painting. That was his own particular taste. He said despite the fact he's gonna live in a glass house, he's gonna have the artwork that he likes to look at. We see that the furnishing in the house itself was all furnished by Mises' designs. He was very fond of Mises, the two of them. But we see here, interestingly enough, in this perspective, he takes the time with the artwork and he in this creating this plane that divides the space, he also takes care as to where the height that he sets it at, so that the horizon line in the painting lines up with the horizon line beyond. So this extreme attention to detail. Here we can see this sculptural form here that is really kind of the only organic or anatomic form in the space, everything being so rectilinear. Little anecdote here I'll read to you, interesting on the sculptural piece. He places this obliquely opposite the painting. The painting is actually at our back right here. We're standing in front of the painting. He puts this on the far corner.
They can look at the painting.
This was a papier-mâché sculptural piece of two embracing women. And he places it as a foil in the space to define the space and kind of like not only divide the space up, but also become a focal point and an accent. And when Frank Lloyd Wright actually visited the house during one of these times, he noticed that
when he went through the house, he moved this this piece because he felt it was in the wrong spot, and that the way that the space was anchored, that it was misplaced and it was throwing the concept of the space off, and so he moved it. And then when Philip came back, he immediately recognized that it was moved and he put it back to where it was. And so then Wright then told him, he said, "Philip, leave perfect symmetry to God." And basically was telling him that, you know, you have to take a little bit of a license to relax it. Unlike Wright's houses, where Wright designed every piece of furniture and every piece of molding, again, we see the furnishings and the fittings in the house were designed by someone else. They weren't designed by Philip. In most cases, it was Mises' work. One other key interest detail between Farnsworth and the glass house is the glass itself. Phil Johnson took the time to order a specific type of glass that has high reflectivity. Mises, on the other hand, got a specific type of glass that had low reflectivity because he wanted the glass to completely disappear. He wanted the walls to disappear, the windows to disappear, essentially to feel like there's no division. Philip was of the other mind, where he wanted you to be aware that the glass was there, that there was a perimeter and there was a definition to the space. He wanted you to be able to see through it, have a transparency to it, but at the same time, he wanted the nature to be reflected into the glass, the trees. And so that way, you by doing so, even in the Farnsworth house, when you sit within the space and you can look out through these windows and you feel like you're in nature, in reality, you're still in the house. In the same case, he can sit within his house, but by having the trees reflected all around him, it makes him feel like he's encompassed by the house, becomes kind of the forest.
And he doesn't have.
That's right. Yeah, he lived, he had a much larger piece of property. He had the luxury of not having to use curtains because he didn't have the neighbors right up on him. But that was an intentional part of his design. We can see here, in the case he's sitting at his desk, and you can see the reflection, again, of these trees.
And this reflective quality was something that was important to him. He said, reflectivity, not just in the glass, but in the reflection necessary to live in a glass house. It is the thinking time that's important time in architecture.
And downtown,
that's right. Right.
PPG is very reflective.
That's right. Yes. So, despite the fact both these houses were glass houses, the approach to the glass was polar opposites between the two. So, with these four individuals, Wright's, Roby House, Corbusier's Villa Savoy, Mies van der Rohe's Farnsworth, and then finally here, Johnson's Glass House, the wall has been eliminated by the window, yet Johnson's window maintains a sense of enclosure by this reflectivity. Not only through the steel columns that are located at the corners, that anchor the corners of the house, but also the reflective glass. All these things, when you're inside the house, creates this perception of a confined space. And so here we see from, if you recall back at the beginning of the lecture, we were talking about how walls create this sense of enclosure. How do you maintain this feeling of enclosure once you eliminate the walls? And so he's trying to find a way to get the window to kind of do what the walls were doing, where you still feel a sense of enclosure by these tricks that he's doing. Exactly. It does that as well. Yeah. So there's multiple things he's adding to this to create this sense of enclosure that he's seen. And more specifically, he's doing this because he recognizes much more so than some of his predecessors that came, to their defense came earlier in the century. But he recognized that this complete dilution or dissolving of this enclosure that we have, that modern architecture is creating, that this is something that would be lost and that he felt was something that would not be good to lose, because at the end of the day, we're biological beings. We have these sensations and these feelings, and we can't just ignore them. We need an architecture that responds to these feelings, and this feeling of enclosure is something that's it's not only is inherent to architecture, but it's something that's necessary to architecture to feel enclosed, to feel, to add to the sense of shelter and safety and these other things. So with that, we'll wrap it up here for today. Pick up next week with Zaha Hadid. If you guys have a moment, I'll throw, I've never done this before, but I'll throw a little homework assignment to you if you're interested. I'll go through this real quick. So some of you might wonder what this has to do with architecture. You might pick up a little bit from today. These ideas that we talked about here today, as far as these elements of architecture, roof, walls, the feelings and the sensations that they create, the essence of it. Where do these sensations come from, number one? But number two, some of the maneuvers that we saw Frank Lloyd Wright and Mies and Korb do with their architecture to kind of manipulate these sensations. Where did these ideas come from? This idea of creativity, many artists, architects, talk about their creative impulses and ideas, and not too many can speak directly and say this is where it comes from specifically. They can talk about inspiration, they can talk about a muse or that type of thing, but where this idea kind of bubbles up inside, and a large part of this is because some of these things are bubbling up from the subconscious. Subconscious is
called the subconscious because it's subconscious. And so you can't locate it. You can't identify it consciously.
And so this is a subject that I have an interest in myself, read up on in studying and trying to understand not only creativity, but things related to the subconscious. And so I wanted to throw out to you an idea that I have to where it's a layering, and it's a layering over time. And if so, if we go back, way back, 500 million years ago, to where we have the emergence of animals coming onto land from the sea. As they come up onto land, one of the things that they develop is this idea of a spinal cord. The fish that were swimming around in the water had a more rudimentary, primitive form of spinal cord, not the type of spinal cord that land animals have with vertebrae, where the spinal cord is broken up into pieces. And so this, we have this spinal cord that's connected to all the body parts, and this spinal cord is used for locomotion on a land surface. Move forward a little bit in time to 65 million years ago, and this spinal cord develops into a brain stem at the end of the spinal cord here. And this brain stem, we start to see developing in things like squirrels at the time. These animals that were on land are now going up into the trees. And this brain stem basically takes all this information that's coming from the extremities up the spinal cord, and it pulls them together and processes all this information together. So the various senses of your different limbs, tactily and various things, are being processed by the brainstem. That then goes forward again to about 6 million years ago, not too long ago in the big picture. We get the cerebellum developed here at the end of the brainstem. This is kind of like a very early primitive brain. This is dealing with, at the same time, around 6 million years ago, we have the chimpanzees that are up in the trees with the squirrels, becoming a little bit more capable of swinging from branch to branch, this idea of brachiation. But the interesting thing is the development of this cerebellum is dealing with things like intuition. This idea that this feeling of intuition that we have, that we act on, we don't necessarily know what these intuitions are coming from or what they're for, but we just feel, you know, this just feels right, and we act on these feelings. And this is what these architects, what these buildings are trying to pay attention to, these feelings. How does this space make you feel? These feelings are not easy to put into words because that comes much later. But these feelings were developing, again, 6 million years ago. Then we get from there into the visual cortex, which is at the back. You have a cerebral lobe here in the back with the where images are developing in the brain from the eyes. And this is about 4 million years ago in early humans. And then finally, 2.4 million years ago, we get into the temporal lobe, which is along the midsection of the cortex. This temporal lobe is dealing with things like handedness. And handedness is rather interesting because most of us have one hand is more dominant than the other, whether it's right or left. Right-handedness is more common than left-handedness. But the fact that the hands have a preference one over the other is an interesting thing. Why can't the two hands just work equally as well? And some people have that ability as well. They can work either way. That said, some of the current theory believes that this handedness was because since we became bipedal, we were able to go walk on our legs. It freed up our hands. We no longer had to use them to walk across the ground. And by freeing up our hands, we could use them for other things like tool making and that type of thing. And so having one hand that could handle fine motor movement and another hand that could handle gross movement separately, because there are different types of mechanisms, was an advantage. And so this developed this handedness. Well, the brain is split down the middle to where you have a right and a left hemisphere. And so if you have the right side of your body, your right hand that's favored actually flips to the left side of the brain, is controlled by the left side of the brain, and vice versa with the left hand. But this right-handedness is
is over on the left-hand side.
And we find then, if we go to just 300,000 years ago, we're talking here in millions of years, just 300,000 years ago, Homo sapiens started to develop what they consider language, verbal communication, in a much more sophisticated way. And lo and behold, this verbal communication happens just on one side of the brain. It happens to be the same side that's controlling the right hand on the right side, physically. And so there's this connection between language and handedness. And more specifically, what gets me interested related to architecture is that the this idea of this more subconscious stimulus that's coming from this earlier primitive brainstem and cerebellum has this intuition that we feel, these sensations. These things were all developed millions of years ago. Just a few minutes long. These intuitions were here long before this language skill came along, just a few thousand years ago. And so as a result, that's still lingering around. We still have intuitions today. We still act on our intuitions today. And we actually have been acting on intuitions for millions of years. And so it's something that we actually have a little bit more control and reliance on than this more recent kind of verbal skill that we have in communication. And this is kind of like the tool set that architects are dealing with spaces. When they're designing a space, they're dealing with these intuitions, trying to create these intuitions, these feelings, these sensations that you have when you come into a space or move about a space. It's this much older subset. And this older subset is related to the body. These intuitions are tied to the spine. The spine is tied to all of your appendages. So it's a bodily sensation that these intuitions come from. It's not just a cerebral mental formulation that language comes from in the cerebral cortex, which is the frontal lobe more recently. And so this gets back to what Philip Johnson was saying about the glass house, is that at the end of the day, we're still physical beings with a body and sensations that are responding to the environment around us, and much the same way that Wright was trying to tie us into the landscape, Johnson is realizing that we can't escape the landscape. We're tied to it, and despite the fact that maybe a lot of these other guys are focused on the frontal cortex, the verbal, the reason, the logic, all this type of thing, these sensations are part and parcel, just as important, if not more important.
Okay, are architects left-handed?
So it's interesting because it's like I do kind of pay attention to, so like when you see certain people like write with their left hand, if you get leaders, it's more common to be left-handed as a leader. Most presidents are left-handed. But just not only presidents, but leaders, so you would say, you know, like a Frank Lloyd Wright or a Corbusier, these well-known architects as compared to someone like me that's just practicing architecture but not as well-known, you might tend to believe, these might be left-handed people, you know, and so I always take interest in that, you know, noticing to see what people write with, because it is kind of a tell sign.
Leonardo.
Wonderful. Right. That's right. And upside down.
Yeah, well.
He took it to the extreme.
Left-handedness is a sign of evil. In the Middle Ages,